Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford. Welcome you to the February 26th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. And every other fifth Wednesday, I want to open the phones to you, our listeners. In just a few moments, I'm going to be speaking once again with investigative journalist Gareth Porter, whose latest book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, was released just last week by Just World Press. I have not seen the book, but I have become familiar with the thrust of its contents and, of course, with the work insights of Grant Porter, who has been my guest 5 times in the past. I think that's the record. Given the parallels between the buildup for the war against Iraq and the drumbeat by Israel and the American politicians in their service to force a regime change in Iran by waging another Middle East war, if necessary, Porter's book could not be more timely. As one reviewer, Peter Jenkins, has written, Porter has been investigating the Iranian nuclear case for the best part of a decade. The result of his researches is both a fascinating addition to a growing corpus, unlike any previous work on the issue, and a disturbing indictment of U.S. and Israeli policies. And you, dear listeners, might be the first radio audience to hear him discuss it. Let's go to Gareth Porter, who I have on the line. Good morning, Gareth, and welcome once again to Takes on the World.
Good morning, Jeff. Glad to be back on the show.
And very glad you're available. You know, in recent weeks, there's been a number of articles we've both seen in the media and online indicating that Israel's premier American lobby, AIPAC, has suffered a major defeat by President Obama's threat to veto new sanctions legislation it drafted against Iran if it comes to his desk, and by the fact that he has been supported in this by the Senate's Democratic majority, which traditionally has been all too willing to genuflect to Israel AIPAC's every demand. This past weekend, however, you wrote that Obama has now agreed to add the status of Iran's missile program to the ongoing negotiations with Iran to reduce its nuclear program, something that only Israel had been demanding. And yesterday, there was a report in the media that the Republican minority is determined to get the new Iran sanctions legislation to the floor against the wishes of Majority Leader Harry Reid and is willing to hold up the passage of other legislation until and unless it gets its way. What's going on here?
Well, as usual, you've got some contradictory aspects of the situation. In this case, I think the contradiction is that, on one hand, you know, Israel has been very successful in manipulating the Senate, in particular, the Senate Republicans, even more specifically, to carry out Israeli policy in the form of demands for this legislation that would, clearly blow up the negotiations with Iran and rule out any possible diplomatic settlement. And of course, to put pressure on the administration with regard to its negotiating position. On the other hand, as you've indicated, I think the situation is that AIPAC has bitten off more than it could chew, in the sense that it has tried to bring about a situation where the administration would be forced into a choice between having to give in to Iran diplomatically, which would be unacceptable politically to it, even though I think it's based on misinformation, as we'll talk about later. Misinformation about the Iranian nuclear program. But the choice would be between that and brandishing the threat of war, if not actually going to war. And it's quite clear that this administration is unwilling to go that far, and that ultimately the Democrats in Congress and in the Senate are not going to be willing to support AIPAC in that regard. So I think we have here clear limits on what AIPAC, and therefore what Israel, is able to accomplish through its manipulation of U.S. politics, obviously through the ability to offer or withdraw its financial support for candidates for office. So that is both, a cause for some optimism, or not optimism, but satisfaction that there are limits on the power of Israel in American politics. But it's also, I think, again, a show that it shows that Israel is very capable of frustrating U.S. diplomacy. And I think that, therefore, it's still very much a cause for concern.
I think they seem to be going much further this time than ever before. On Saturday, two of the officials of AIPAC had an op-ed in the New York Times saying, don't let up on Iran, and telling Congress what should be U.S. policy. And with AIPAC opening its conference in Washington on Monday, on the 1st, and Netanyahu coming to address it, this looks like AIPAC's decided to have a full-out confrontation with the administration rather than withdrawing and licking its wounds for another day.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt that the Netanyahu government is determined to do everything it can to frustrate U.S. diplomacy and, indeed, to bring about, if at all possible, a military confrontation between the United States and Iran. That has been Netanyahu's aim all along. That is his maximum aim. I mean, you know, let's be clear about this. Bibi Netanyahu does not really believe that Iran poses an existential threat to Israel. From all the evidence that I have gathered and given in my book to the readers of Manufactured Crisis, this government does not genuinely believe that it is threatened by the Iranian nuclear program. That's a ruse that has been going on for a couple of decades. Of course, Netanyahu has been in office twice, and he has been responsible for that ruse in both cases. But what is the more immediate aim of Netanyahu? The shorter-term and more easily obtainable aim has been to use the threat of an attack on Iran by Israel to get the United States and especially the other major powers who are involved in these negotiations, the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese, to support the extremely harsh sanctions, which they have indeed endorsed, you know, in the sense that they have not done anything to prevent the United States from negotiating these sanctions with its allies in Europe and Asia. So in that sense, the Israelis have been very successful in manipulating international opinion and international policy toward Iran by this ruse that they are so threatened by the Iranian nuclear program that they consider it an existential threat.
It also appears they might be willing to challenge Obama's threat to veto the legislation. I don't believe any American president has ever vetoed a piece of legislation supported by Israel and the Israel lobby. And I think they're counting on him not doing that. What do you think he actually might go ahead and actually veto it? They don't have enough votes in the Senate right now to override his veto, but that might not be their concern. They may be thinking about the election and capturing the Senate in 2016. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, I think that the threat by Obama to veto this legislation is genuine. It's real. I think that he recognizes that should this legislation go into effect, that the United States would lose its ability essentially to negotiate any agreement with Iran. It would simply be out of the question. The Iranians would undoubtedly break off the talks because there would simply be no way that an agreement could be reached in the face of the demands that are involved in this legislation. So I think that is genuine. You know, you are correct that at this point it doesn't appear, at least as clear-cut as we would like, that the Senate could override that veto. On the other hand, if the president is committed strongly enough to the position, which I believe he is committed to, that this legislation would force the United States into a situation of war or near war with Iran, I think that there is a good chance that he could muster the necessary votes from the Democrats in the Senate to veto the legislation.
Do you think that under the circumstances, the the president, you wrote about it. So you wrote about the president mentioning that Iran's missile program would be on the agenda. It was something that he had not put on the agenda before, but Israel had been demanding, which you wrote about on the 22nd. What effect do you think that's going to have on the Iranians, who obviously would not accept that?
Well, it certainly, as I point out in the article that you just referred to, it certainly does mean that the negotiations would be deadlocked if the United States were serious about pressing that demand on behalf of Israel. But as I point out in the article, there is good reason to doubt that that is the case. At the lower down in the article, and I think many readers may miss this because it is not prominent enough at the top of the article, I suggest that it's very likely that what is happening here is that the administration thought that it could get sort of a cheap political advantage by doing this, sort of making this demand on behalf of the Israelis, and of course under pressure from the Republicans in the Senate, because they would know that the Russians would never allow that demand to go forward in the negotiations. And bear in mind that officially the ground rules of these negotiations are that the P5 plus one, that is the United States, the three European countries, Russia and China, must all agree to negotiating positions that are moved to the table in the negotiations with Iran. So there's every reason to believe that the Russian opposition to this position, which has been made public by the deputy foreign minister of Russia, would in fact prevent the United States from actually acting on it. And knowing that, I think the administration probably felt that it had what would be called in pro football a free play, you know, knowing that there was an error, a flag thrown on the play, that they could go ahead and go for the long ball, and they would not suffer any consequences if they failed.
Actually, that's a very good analogy. I see the point in your article. You mentioned that it protects his image here, and he has nothing to lose because they probably have told the Iranians that we have to say this, but we're not serious. Now,
right. In this case, of course, the president is throwing a long ball, which is deliberately out of bounds. He's not intending to complete the pass. So in that sense, it's not an accurate analogy, but you get the point, obviously.
I get the point. Now let's talk about how we got here, and your book is all about the manufacturing crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. And since we're in our pledge program, we're offering this to our listeners for $150 pledge. Tell us about how this long process was manufactured to bring us to the point we are today.
Well, of course, it's necessary to really summarize this in a way that doesn't do it justice, but I think the best way that I can summarize it is to say that you have a combination of misinformation based in part on a historical narrative that was inaccurate and served the political purposes of the U.S. Successive U.S. administrations over the years, beginning in the early 1990s, on one hand, and disinformation, that is, actual fabrication of documents and intelligence reports by the Israelis, which constitutes a very central element in this whole story of how a crisis was indeed manufactured unnecessarily and in a way that is completely misleading to the unwary viewer and a newspaper reader, obviously, has been for many years. So what I've done is to document a long process that does begin in the early 1990s with what I show is an intelligence failure by the CIA's analysts on proliferation of weapons of mass destruction based on their misreading of a set of telexes. And then, you know, that quickly was turned into a public conclusion that Iran was aiming at having nuclear weapons. In fact, that Iran was developing nuclear weapons. That was the term that was used in the 1990s by U.S. officials in the national security state. And that was a rather self-serving way of describing even the intelligence that they had mistakenly concluded, the intelligence judgments that they had mistakenly adopted previously. So what you had there was very politically shaped, politically distorted intelligence, which set the stage for a policy that from the United States, particularly from the Clinton administration, that was very much influenced by Israel's demands, and that is a part of the story that I detail early in the book. And then we come to the heart of the creation of a manufactured crisis with the George W. Bush administration, and I explain in the book how John Bolton, the primary policymaker for the Bush administration on weapons of mass destruction and proliferation, was clearly operating in very close coordination with Israel to set up a situation where the IAEA consideration of the Iran file, if you will, would be terminated, and the file would be moved to the UN Security Council. That was the plan that John Bolton actually talks about openly in his memoirs. That was his intention. And in order to do that, he maneuvered in various ways to create so-called evidence that Iran was working on experimenting with nuclear weapons related technology. And of course, the most important alleged evidence of all was produced in 2004, turned over to the CIA, and was made public by Secretary of State Colin Powell in offhand remarks to the press in November 2004, then given to the IAEA. In my book, I reveal for the first time that those documents allegedly from a purloined Iranian scientist computer, a member of this purported covert nuclear weapons program, actually was turned over to the German intelligence agency, the BND, by a member of the Mujahideen-e Khalq. As we all know, that was a terrorist organization for very good reasons. It was on the terrorist list in the United States and in European countries. And the BND did not consider the source, that MEK member, to be a reliable source, and therefore wanted to warn the United States not to rely on this information. And in that sense, this constitutes a very direct parallel, an astonishingly direct parallel, with the whole episode of Curveball during the run-up to the Iraq War. Curveball, of course, was a BND source. He was an Iraqi who lived in Germany. He was not a German citizen. He had fled to Germany and began telling tales of mobile bioweapons labs to German intelligence officers who were debriefing him, and they passed on those stories to the CIA. And of course, that became the centerpiece of Colin Powell's talk at the United Nations in 2003 as a justification for the Bush administration's invasion and occupation of Iraq. And so in 2004, when Colin Powell made reference to this information, which the German BND senior officials knew was from those documents, they were quite alarmed. And the source who gave me this information, a senior official of the Foreign Office in Germany, told me that the BND officials were clearly upset with the Bush administration, and they were alarmed that, that history was going to repeat itself. So this is an astonishing parallel, an abuse of intelligence that should not have been relied upon, that the CIA had been warned about, clearly, by its German counterpart, but which nevertheless has become the centerpiece of the case against Iran, and which we know now that the Bush administration, at least the neoconservatives in the Bush administration, had actually intended to use as the basis for what might be eventually an attack by the United States on Iran.
As you say, the parallels between Iraq and Iran are extraordinary, and you say you have many of the same players. They got away with Iraq, destroyed the country, and split it up in a following a plan of an Israeli political analyst, Oded Yanan, back in the 80s, dividing it into his religious confessions. And now it seems they are relentless and have been so since the Iraq War in doing the same thing to Iran. What are Israel's motives?
Israel's motives with regard to Iran specifically, you mean?
Yes.
Well, you know, this is a bit more complex than it appears at first glance. The reason is that there is no single Israeli view on Iran. And in my book, I document the fact that historically, Mossad in particular has been very resistant to the idea that Israel should get itself into a hostile relationship, a conflictual relationship with Iran. The reason being that Mossad has believed ever since the Islamic Republic was created that the time would come when Iran would once again be an ally of Israel, as was the Shah's regime for many years. And so Mossad has been a center of resistance to the idea that Iran has been and still is an existential threat to Israel. And this is very well known in Israeli national security circles. And indeed, last year I spoke with a former Mossad official who told me that idea is still very much, that idea that Israel should not be provoking a high level of tension with Iran, because there still will come a day when Iran will once again be an ally of Israel. That is still a school of thought that is very much alive within Mossad. And then if you look at the IDF, high-ranking IDF officials, they certainly have never been eager to get involved in a war with Iran. That has never been their desire. They've always been opposed to that, and they've made it very clear over the years to Bibi Netanyahu. And I talk about how that has created a high degree of tension between the past IDF chief and Netanyahu. So Netanyahu's viewpoint on Iran, the claim that Iran is an existential threat, is by no means shared by the National Security League in Israel. But I think what Netanyahu's interest here is to manipulate, as I pointed out, the international community in general, and the United States in particular, to reduce the power of Iran. I mean, what Netanyahu and Likud want is for the United States to essentially take care of the problem of a regional rival for power in the Middle East of Israel. Israel, of course, being the only nuclear power in the region, and the strongest military power by far in the region, does not want any other power to have the ability to limit the Israeli free use of military power by Israel. And this is what really bothers the leadership of the present government and many others in Israel. So I think this is the main aim that Netanyahu has had over the period of his term in office.
How much does Iran's support for Hezbollah, the bane of Israel's military, play in this?
Well, of course, that is definitely an interest of the Israelis to try to put pressure on Iran to terminate its relationship, its support for Hezbollah. There's no doubt about that. The Israelis would like to see a Lebanon without a highly armed Shia majority or near majority of the population in Lebanon. And that, of course, is one of the things that they constantly talk about. They want to get the international community to condemn Hezbollah, and they want the community to put pressure on Iran over that issue. So I agree that is another element of the interest underlying the present Israeli policy toward Iran.
One of the arguments I believe you make is also that Israel needs to maintain itself as a strategic ally of the United States in the region where now things are falling apart, and that maintaining a high tension serves Israel's interests and, of course, the lobby and the military-industrial complex, which works with it, all seem to benefit from this confrontational posture.
Well, that's right. The interest in maintaining the United States as an ally is a primary concern of Israel always under both Labor and Likud. And in fact, I go back in the book to the Rabin government in 1993-94. Which was the first one, really, to start talking about an existential threat from Iran. And I show that what the real concern was at that point was a combination of using the alleged Iranian threat as a way of justifying the negotiations with the PLO at that point, which was the policy of the Rabin government, in opposition to a majority of public opinion in Israel. So basically, the Rabin government was trying to find a way to ease the opposition of public opinion to its primary policy at that point, the negotiations with PLO. But the second interest that the Rabin government had in mind was that they were worried that the United States would be less concerned about having Israel as an ally because of the demise of the Soviet Union and therefore the decline of threat from the Soviets in the Middle East. And therefore, the Israeli government at that point believed that citing, sort of building up an Iranian threat, particularly the idea that Iran was going to become a nuclear weapons state, would be a way to bind the United States more tightly to Israel, to make that alliance between the United States and Israel more important to the United States for the foreseeable future.
And essentially what you found is that all the talk about Iran's nuclear program over the years, starting and stopping, and their secret plans, despite their disclaimers, has all been a fabrication. And this is what you illustrate in your book.
That's right. The fabrication is not, I mean, the primary fabrication, as I've suggested, were these documents that were aimed at showing that Iran was mating or trying to mate a nuclear weapon with their Shahab 3 missile in 2002-2003, and also depicting experiments with exploding bridge wire, high explosives that could be used supposedly to detonate a nuclear weapon. And those were the sort of high-profile documents that the Bush administration tried to show as smoking gun evidence that Iran was working on nuclear weapons. Well, I mean, you know, these were clearly fabrications, and I show not only that they came from the MEK, which, of course, was working hand in glove with Mossad at that point, doing its bidding, but also that there are contradictions within or between the information in those documents, some information in those documents, and well-established timelines of the Iranian missile program and nuclear program, so that they could not possibly be authentic. And it shows that it was an outside hand that was actually doing these drawings and other documents that simply was not aware at that time of the contradiction that the contradictions that I document. So that's the central disinformation project that has been used to prove that Iran was aiming at nuclear weapons. But there's a whole train of misinformation that involves the IAEA investigation and charges that the IAEA made in a series of reports from 2004 on, all of which turned out, as I point out in the book, as I document in the book, all of them turned out to be just false alarms. They were false positives. In the end, the IAEA could not cite any evidence to contradict what the Iranians did to explain each case. And indeed, in the end, they cleared the Iranians, saying that the information the Iranians gave was consistent with the information that they had, or that they could not find anything that was inconsistent. They could not say anything that was inconsistent with it. So that whole period of IAEA investigation, which generated one story after another, an endless train of stories in the U.S. and foreign media, suggesting that Iran obviously was doing something that indicated that it was working on nuclear weapons, and which I must say has caused the entire U.S. and European political elites and media elites to be completely converted to this point of view. All of that turns out to have been simply completely false.
Well, Gareth, we're coming down to the end of our interview. I have many more questions to ask you. First, a comment about the power and the importance of public radio stations like ours.
Yes, I would comment that the situation in this country is really dire in terms of the way in which the commercial news media are misinforming the American people with regard to issues that involve the most important interests of the American people of all. That is, to be safe from foreign from threats coming from abroad and from within the United States itself that are related to U.S. policy. And I know I don't have to go into greater detail about what that means. Clearly, the American people are being misinformed daily about U.S. policies, which need to be exposed, which need to be changed. And it's up to alternative media, such as your station, your program, to get this word out. And we need far more of this than we have already. But we need to keep the media, which are working on this, on trying to bring out the truth, to preserve them and keep them going. That's for sure.
Well, I want to thank you. I also want to tell our listeners, I'm looking forward to meeting you in person next on the 7th of March, when we both will be participating in a long-overdue national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. So I look very much forward to meeting you then, and thank you so much for being our guest today and providing this book for us and for our listeners. So thanks, Gareth Porter, from me and from all our listeners for coming on the air and giving us this very important information.
Well, Thanks very much, Jeff, and I look forward to meeting you in March.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.